Hi, welcome to the new Givergy podcast season, the secret guide to fundraising. I'm Ben, Givergy COO, and as a team of fundraising experts, we help clients worldwide raise as much money as possible. This is possible thanks to our award-winning platform and our team's consultative approach, which provide the tools to raise more online and at events. Our clients always comment on how helpful our advice is, so we wanted to share some exclusive insights into our latest podcast series, which will get behind the scenes of modern fundraising. We're excited to share our fundraising best practices, tips, and tricks through this medium, so sit back and enjoy the show. In today's episode, we will be chatting about a subject often cloaked in mystery within the giving sector: non-profit collaboration versus donor competition. With so many non-profits fundraising for similar causes, should they work together or compete for the same donor? Join us on this podcast episode as we explore the taboo topic with Paul D'Alessandro, a veteran fundraiser and consultant. We'll dive into the benefits and challenges of collaboration, what works for long-term strategy, and some alternative partnership models. So firstly, Paul, how are you?
I'm doing great, Ben. I'm just so happy to be on here on this podcast with you.
Well, no, we're loving having you with us. And for the people listening in, I can see your background and it's covered in a type of smog. So I think something's going on in New York right now.
Well, just out to know the time we're doing this, this is when the Canadian fires have come into the Northeast U.S. and I'm just outside of New York City. And yesterday it was covered in an orange haze and it should be worse today. We've not seen this ever. And they're advising everybody not to go out. So by the time people listen to this, it will have passed, hopefully.
Hopefully. Well, you know what? It's an even better time to be on a podcast chatting to us guys about fundraising then.
Absolutely.
And Paul, were you born in New York?
I was born in Brooklyn, raised in Jersey, but I've lived mostly on the eastern seaboard of the United States, spent a bunch of time in Florida, Washington, D.C., but also I've lived in Austria, and I'm quite fond of Europe, as I've mentioned to you before.
You have. I think you're also an Italian citizen as well.
I do have my Italian citizenship, which will allow me to run around the EU if I have that luxury.
I've got a feeling that's where you're going to end up in life. You're very passionate about where I am in Europe.
Yep.
So if we talk a little bit firstly about your fundraising journey, where did it all begin?
Well, I started on a path to become a lawyer and I went through law school and then I took a job in Washington, D.C. doing international tax work, which led to consulting with U.S. multinationals on their benefits and comp plans for U.S. expats and third country nationals. And mostly it was, how do you shelter income from taxes? Because all the different countries around the world tax differently. So I've got a lot of experience dealing with high net worth donors. So my university, which I graduated from, the University of Notre Dame, knew that. I was friends with the head of the business school. And he said, Paul, we're doing a major capital campaign, $350 million. And we're wondering if you would be interested in helping us with major gift donors in the Southeast U.S. And I said, sure. And that's how I wound up in Florida, because the office was in Palm Beach, Florida, which was not a bad place to be. And we conducted a $350 million campaign right when the stock market crashed in the late 80s, and we raised $450 million. And that was how I got into the fundraising journey. I actually started thinking that I would meet very wealthy people and find out the person who is had the most money and the happiest doing it. And I've yet to find that person. But I did find a passion for relationships with people who are so fascinating, you know, around the country and actually around the globe.
Yeah, I bet. And what a journey. And do you still feel as passionate about fundraising now in the, you know, 2023 versus how you felt in the 80s when you just got into it?
It's a lot different now. So I'm still passionate about, you know, people and all the different needs around the world, you know, and they're vast. But it's changed so much, and it's changed so much with tech, which we could talk about. And of course, donors are overwhelmed. When I started in my own consulting firm, there were only 400,000 nonprofits in the U.S. alone. Now there's over 1.5 million charities, a lot of competition.
So much, which is why we're having this conversation.
Yes, and donors are weary.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, if you think about the pandemic as well, that 3 year, 2 to 12, still kind of, you know, coming out of it. I think that's really changed the landscape a lot as well. Would you agree?
Oh, sure. You know, I call it the Great Migration because it gave people the opportunity to move. So, you know, you talk about people's databases and all that. So people from the Northeast, let's say, you know, who had, if they were in high tax areas, they moved to the Southeast, to South Carolina, to North Carolina, to Florida, so many to Florida. And then there were people who were in California and the Pacific Northwest, and they moved to Texas and they moved to Idaho. And so there was this great shift of donors because they had the latitude to do that. And so that settled them down a little bit. We were on a path of just so much activity, so many events, so many people being, you know, overwhelmed with things to do. And then it kind of stopped. And then I'm speaking mostly about wealthy people. They got a reset about what's important in their life. And so family is important and trying to get a better pace of life.
But it's interesting you say this because we did a podcast during the middle of it all. And I spoke to an amazing fundraiser in British Columbia. And she said exactly the same thing. She was like, so she was consulting lots of different charities. And she was like, well, you know what? There's a really big challenge because all these high net worth individuals have all going to move to different places and away from the cities. And now we're trying to get them to come back in and attend, you know, like you're saying, where before it was so event centric and everyone knew what they were doing in September and all that kind of stuff. And she was like, she at that point said, I predict that people aren't going to migrate back in the way they did before. And also even the way they want to give is going to be different. And I think it seems to be, it seems like you're saying, it seems to be true. It's kind of changed, hasn't it? The way that we could kind of bank on what was going to happen before.
Sure. I mean, I have one client, so many people, they're in Michigan, and they did an event in April. And there were a lot of people who hadn't come back from Florida. So then they offered to do another event in just last month, late May. And they had over 100 people come who mostly were in the Southeast, and they came back and they raised as much money at that event on May as they did in April. And so, and the people who came up who were resident of Michigan, well, actually they're resident of Florida for tax purposes, but they now said, look, we will do events in Florida. You come to Florida and we will introduce you to our friends in Florida.
Interesting, isn't it? It's such a different time. And, you know, just in terms of how you support fundraisers now, can you just tell the listeners a little bit more about how you help people right now?
Well, you know, it's changed because we as a firm, you know, we started doing capital campaigns and feasibility studies and kind of the typical things that nonprofit consulting firms did. But now there's so many, you know, back when we started, there weren't a lot of development directors, there weren't a lot of staff, but that's all changed. And tech has changed so much. So right now we're helping not on long-term contracts, short-term contracts, you know, helping development or offices get structured, what they need to do to think forwardly 3 to 5 years ahead and even into the future. You know, we're coaching the executive directors and, you know, we're doing capital campaigns, but more on a much smaller fee basis because the clients and even major gift programs, because the client said, you don't need to come see us. I mean, back in the time when I started, I would get on an airplane and I'd be gone for 4 days. I'd come home and I would do that week after week after week and I'd be on site. Well, now Zoom's allowed us to be much more efficient in meetings. Now, as far as seeing individual donors at high net worth, yes, individual meetings are important. And I used to go on so many of those meetings. I've actually been on over 4,000. But we have now coached the staff to how to make an ask and how to be comfortable in that, because ultimately they have to own that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's interesting what you just said there is, like you said, you know, before you would go away for 4 days and you'd be, I'm guessing, focused really on kind of one client and one project. And everyone I kind of speak to now as well, you are able to also support more because it's not just so intense. Like you were on the plane and you're flying and you're driving and then you're there and then, and the whole thing. So there is, although like you're right, in person is really great and you can never change how brilliant that is. But I think from even what fundraisers do and what you are doing, it is great that you can actually now support in a way lots more people and then maybe even improve the whole work-life balance as well.
No, it does. I mean, during COVID, I still traveled. I was in 20 states during COVID. You know, I'd hit the Western states and you know, I drove down into Florida. But it's interesting. We were able to capture $500,000 gifts via Zoom, you know, conduct events via Zoom like a lot of other people. But there were still people some people willing to do one-on-one events. But then there came to be some Cheap Nation, you know, there was the vax people and the anti-vax people. So some of the donors who didn't get vaxxed were invited to events in New York, let's say, and that you had to be vaccinated in New York. So they said, well, I'm not going to your event because you have to be vaccinated. So it became a little messy for a time.
Yeah, and complex, because we had the same challenge, you know, in Givergy's position. We found that most countries that we operated in closed down completely, like not one single event, where America, it did carry on, and every state was different. And we had the same where clients were like, I've got a real challenge where we kind of want to do the event, but we have all these rules and regulations, so we don't really know how we're going to do it. And it sounds like you were navigating the exact same challenge.
Yeah. And I think everyone, I was at a symposium yesterday in New York, and there are about 100 nonprofits there, and they're all talking about how things have settled down since 2020, but they're still talking about the recovery from COVID, you know, and donors and events and everything.
It's going to be, unfortunately, it is going to take a few more years, isn't it, until we're also not talking about it, because it's funny, isn't it? It's something we've been talking about now. It feels like for a lifetime. And just importantly as well, you also wrote a book on events that we also do, because we do the future of fundraising events, where we talk about that. But you've written a book about it. Do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about the book?
Well, thanks. And yeah, it was, I had the idea probably right before COVID, but COVID provided an opportunity to write it. And I wrote it not on the things that fundraisers traditionally write on, which is, you know, how do you make an ask? How do you do major gift ask? It's, where are we going? How is this space changing? And, you know, there's 10 chapters in it. The first two chapters back I wrote in 2020 was on artificial intelligence. And now with ChatGPT and everything, you know, even that's changed. We talk about impact investing, where donors are putting the money, diaspora giving, and, you know, blockchain, philanthropy. And the last chapter is about how donors are thinking differently today about nonprofits. But it's really about the trends that are going on in this space and how nonprofits ought to be thinking forwardly, because if they rely on the same methods of generating revenue, they're going to miss big spots. You know, one of the things we wrote about was on crypto. At the time, crypto was a big thing, but it's still a very big thing. And, you know, as things come back, people will give a lot of money via crypto and all the other vehicles like Fast Cash and Apple Pay and the like.
Yeah, and I can imagine, and I think it's really important as well to, you know, especially in 2020, you're already ahead of the curve. You know, when I've just done a tour in five of our countries that we operate in, and so many fundraisers are asking the questions that are in your book. And they're like, you know, should we start to be thinking about crypto? And we're like, well, actually, we don't actually know yet. So like we're not that ahead in terms of that side. Or people, you know, a lot of people keep saying to us recently about the possible, you know, controversial word, death of gala dinner, where, you know, a lot of fundraisers keep saying to us, I don't know if in 20 years we're still going to be doing that exact same thing, where they said like 10 years ago, I could guarantee it. And it seems the whole landscape is so changing now into this digital, like you said, ChatGPT, crypto, gaming, all these different things that people are asking us all the time. So I think it's definitely worth having a read of your book and trying to explore that. And that's something we're trying to do on this podcast as well, is go more into those types of subjects as well.
Yeah. There's somebody else just recently wrote a book called The Generosity Crisis. And they, in that book, they predicted kind of the demise of nonprofits in the next 49 years. So what I try and tell my clients is, if you think about to continue to do business as you have in the past, you will be left behind by those who are paying attention to all the changes that they made. Because at the end of the day, we're still going to have needs of people who need help. But how we get the money is going to change.
Totally. And you've got to adapt. That's it. It's if you don't adapt now, or start to at least consider it and think ahead. You know, you hear lots of fundraisers where they're going, well, you know, each year I'm struggling to retain donors, I'm struggling to get new ones on board, and those kind of things. And sometimes you listen and you think, okay, but what are you going to do? You need a plan. You know, I'll just keep talking about it. But then you have some really exciting charities or fundraisers come along and they'll be like, wow, I've tried this complete new idea. And it's those new ideas that kind of need to be talked about more and shared. And I find sometimes, and if you would agree, that fundraisers sometimes know about the challenge And they even know the solution, but until somebody else at another nonprofit does it, they're like, oh, now I'm going to do it. Yeah, because that charity's done it. Actually, yes, it's going to push me to do it as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I also tell my clients, they've got to invest in those things that are going to make them successful. And if you're not investing in technology, you definitely are going to left behind. You know, I should mention the different companies, but, you know, there's one company you could pick your database, load it in. And I just did this for a client. They put in 20,000 names because we were developing a major gift program for them. And after the names all got uploaded, we came up with 233 major gift donors. And they met a criteria, had worth over $2 million. They gave it to environmental. And, you know, they met a whole bunch of criteria. And then the exec called me up and said, we don't know any of those people. I said, that's the point. That's what it does for us. It tells you who these people are. Now you need to go, the data is great, but now you need to do the next thing. Now you need to go see them. So you don't need to spend weeks and months trying to figure out who has resources. Tech will do that for you.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? The power of AI and data mining. I was speaking to somebody the other day. I attended the AFP Icon event a couple of months ago in New Orleans. And I remember I went to the Vegas one the year before, and there was, let's say, two data companies. And then this year, there was a whole alleyway of just data. And I was like, okay, and not only are the nonprofits listening, but also there's more companies then propping up going, now we'll mine your data. And I suppose that's a whole other episode on, you know, picking the right one and all those kind of things. But it just shows you that more charities are, well, nonprofits are waking up and going, if I use that kind of really powerful tool and AI, it could very quickly get me in front of the people I actually need to be speaking to.
Well, that's, you know, if you went 15 years ago, it would be consulting firms, you know, all the big, you know, Blackwood be there, but I won't even mention all the big consulting firms. But now you're right. It's all the tech companies, because that's where money's going into the space. Look at Bonterra, just by example, you know, $2 billion to assume three tech companies. And I think it was Network for Good. There's a lot of money because the power of owning the information, there's database of information, especially people in the US, because the GDPR is different, you know, in Europe. But that is gold to trying to find who the best prospects are in the US. And ultimately, that's great. But you still, once you have the data, like I said, you still have to have somebody who knows how to build a relationship with somebody and ask for a gift. And I think AI is going to change that too, because donors are weary of being asked so much by so many.
Yeah, absolutely. And then again, it's a whole other subject, isn't it? Because AI is sometimes driving fear. And I don't think it needs to, because you still need talent. It's just these tools can help get you to your results, I think, quicker. You know what I mean? But like I said, it's a whole other subject. But I think, you know, with the whole subject of AI, it needs to be embraced, not feared by fundraisers, in my opinion.
Right. Which will lead to, you know, some of the donor competition and the, you know, operation.
Well, let's dive into some of the main questions. We've kind of already started to talk about it anyway as well. So, you know, the main subject for this podcast is around, you know, should nonprofits collaborate more? And really delving into the challenge around donor competition, because like you said, you know, a few minutes ago, you know, I think you said in America, there was, you know, in the 80s, like 400,000 nonprofits. Now there's one, did you say maybe 1.2 or 1.4 million, which is an amazing amount. But also there is so many nonprofits, as we're finding, in the exact same space and sometimes raising for the exact same cause, even in the same town or city. And, you know, in Givergy, in our position, we do see that a lot. And that's why we thought, you know, it'd be really good to start to talk a little bit more about that, because it is a taboo subject. Some people are like, actually, no, we shouldn't collaborate. Some people are starting to consider it. So hopefully this episode will get some people thinking and maybe considering, you know, this is an option. So we're going to start with the first question, which is around examples. So in your, you know, in your career history, have you got any great examples that you might be able to share where nonprofits have come together and found success?
Sure. You know, I got a phone call a couple of years back from somebody in Ohio, and he said, you know, Paul, I'm working on I'm working with this charity, but there's six other charities like us in our community. And it was a big city. And he said, what shall we do? And I said, you really need to pull everybody together, because, you know, you have so many duplication of services. But the best example that I've seen recently is a client that I had. It was a Thanks. And they were raising about $2.5 million a year. And they were competing with another charity, both national charities, and they were raising about $5 million a year. And with foresight, both boards said, you know, I think, you know, we really need to merge and have a greater impact. It took about a year or two because, you know, the nonprofits somewhat are territorial and they think they do better than everybody else. They had one executive director who was, you know, being paid over $300,000 a year, and the other one was making less, you know, a lot less. And so they came together and then they merged. So after they merged, they're now doing probably $12 million a year together. The one executive director got a package, you know, for 3 years at, you know, his current salary, but they've done so much more. One, on a greater impact around the U.S., actually around the globe. And two, it was so less confusing for donors because they were talking to the same donors. Because it was a disease that most people were affected by. So that's just one that comes to mind right now. But, you know, what I was going to say to you is, like, where I live, you know, outside of the city in New Jersey, there's 40,000 nonprofits. In Florida, where I also lived, you know, there's 50,000 nonprofits, and they add 10,000 nonprofits a year. And so, you know, we're not adding that many major donors a year. So, but that health organization is probably the best example that I see. But I tell, you know, my clients that you have to look for opportunities for mergers. That was a merger, but you also need to look for collaborations. And why is that? It makes good business sense, but donors want to see it too. You know, the donors want to see that you're being really effective with the dollars that they give you. And they'll say to you, you know, well, what's the difference between you and, you know, the similar organization in the community? How are you guys different? How are you guys working together?
I suppose, you know, just listening to that, it's also quite distracting. You know, as a donor, you're having to kind of get a sales pitch to give to the, like you're saying, to the charity that are doing, to a nonprofit that's doing the same thing. And it must be quite, I just think from a donor experience, that's probably a lot going on as well, because, you know, you're using these tools and all the things out there, they're probably going for the same person each time. And then, you know, he or she is having to try and make the decision, well, which one do I think is going to do the best job? But I'm sure they're all doing a brilliant job. But you're right. I just think, even thinking about the donor experience, they must sit there and know this and think, well, why is it in, you know, LA, there's four charities I've already been spoken to and they're all trying to solve kidney disease. I'm making it up. They must also sit there and think, I wonder why they don't come together.
Yeah, it's, you know, so it creates donor fatigue. And, you know, donors have, they don't have an unlimited amount of money to give. They know what they want to give. So, and, you know, they know that they're going to get approached by somebody. So they just, their gifting gets kind of watered down, if you will. So let's say you have $15,000 or $10,000 to give. You know, you can give it all to one charity or give all, you know, a bunch to a lot of different charities. You know, we've done a lot of work with the Catholic Church. And that's, if you look at the Catholic Church, you have the diocese, the archdiocese, then you have Catholic Charities, then you have the Catholic high schools, the Catholic colleges, yeah, the parishes, you know, and that's just one area. So if you have a deep Catholic faith and you want to give there, but then you also have other things that people care about, but you don't have unlimited funds to help charities. So it would make things easier. And again, I think AI is going to change that for both donors and for the nonprofits.
Yeah, I agree. And it just goes back to how important this kind of conversation is and for charities to be considering things like this, because it is with the power of AI, and I'm only just learning, but the more and more I learn about it, you know, those same people are going to flag on multiple tools and, you know, you're going to have multiple people coming in for the same subject. So the quicker you kind of start to think out of the box and possibly collaborate, to me, sounds definitely worth considering. If you were, you know, from your experience, if, you know, for nonprofits that are sitting out there now listening to this podcast and they're like, well, I kind of thought about it, but how do you think they should even go about it if they were to even think about trying to do something together?
Well, it's about, you know, I look at it in my variable for a lot, most nonprofits is leadership, you know, and, you know, I've got a nonprofit that I'm currently working with in New Jersey and they work in a certain region. And then they have another nonprofit that does the same thing. One executive director is strong, the other one not so strong. And the donors are telling them that they need to work because they're supporting both charities. But there's a willingness because, you know, there, like I said, there's a, not an isolation, but there's an unwillingness to give up control of what was created. And some, you know, in mergers in particular, people are going to lose their jobs because we're heavy in admin. I mean, 10% of the U.S. population now is working in the nonprofit sector. That's the statistic I was given yesterday. But there's economies of scale in doing that, because at the end of the day, what are we trying to do? We want to have a greater good. So it takes leadership from a board member, from a board to start having a conversation, or from the executive director side. Now, like I said, there is a big distinction between merging, which is one thing, which makes great sense, and collaboration. One of the clients that we work for, Habitat International, for instance, you know, they have a lot, at the time that I was consulting with them, over 1,500 affiliates around the U.S. And so, you know, even within themselves, they were competing within regions, you know, and trying to get ownership of donors. So it becomes problematic.
I think what's really important to understand as well for people listening in, the USA, it is probably, you know, we operate in 5 countries. It is the most complex region to understand out of anywhere we operate in, because even the word chapters, I said to someone the other day, and I was in Australia, I was like, well, you know, some charities have chapters. And they're like, what's a chapter? And I was like, so imagine you've got your charity, and then even within its own state, it might have multiple chapters, which are like branches or offices that are then all working together. But sometimes they don't work together. They report to a head office, and this person was like mind boggled. Like, I don't get it. It's that big. I'm like, that's how big fundraising is in the US, where other countries, they don't get it. Like, well, we have one, we all work together, and we're just branches of the same team. It's you know what I mean? It's so different, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's called a federated model, but you know, you could create, so you have, they create separate tax exempt entities, separate 501c3s. And so every 501c3 tax exempt charity then needs to have a board. So you could have in one state, you know, 20 quote, affiliates of the parent, if you will, whether it's Boys and Girls Club, Habitat for Humanity, Red Cross is different, but because there's different models. So, but they all have that overhead and that structure to deal with. And sometimes it's driven by, you know, the creation of a tax exempt status in the United States.
Yeah, that's driving it. And again, that is a unique thing more to the US, I'd find, than other countries that we operate in. It's so interesting, but it's so different in a sense.
Yeah, and what happens is they get into who owns the donor, you know? So you can't cross this county line because our affiliate owns this geographic territory. But, you know, people don't think, when they give money, they don't think in terms of that. So what happens sometimes is like an affiliate in one city will write a check to that charity, but it'll go to the parent charity, which is based somewhere else in the US. But the intent was to give to local charity. So it gets very confusing. So it's another reason, you know, it will change in time, because donors, again, don't want to be confused by this. They're used to it, but there's just more and more charities popping up.
Which again drives the question around, you know, collaboration. But it's interesting this point, because that's within itself, that's within, you know, the same nonprofit, you know, that kind of battle is going on. And hopefully that, you know, do you think there is a solution to that that could help, you know, these charities that are much bigger and dealing with that level of, like, that kind of scale?
Well, so some of the charities, you know, what they're doing is trying to do some consolidation within regions and within states, and they will force some of the mergers and stuff because some of them can't self-sustain themselves. So you have a charity in a very wealthy community and they generate a lot of money. And then you have a charity, the same affiliate, in a very poor community, but they have to get their money from the wealthy communities. So at some point, you know, they're all going to have to come together. You know, I'm just thinking as we're speaking, you could probably go to ChatGPT and say, what charities support human services in, you know, in the city that I live? And then a donor is going to then see all these charities, and then they're going to say, well, how are these different? You know, and why are there so many of them? And I think, again, technology and donors are going to drive the change that needs to happen. So if you're a nonprofit and you're listening to this, you know, you have to see what makes you different. And if you're not different, then who is like you? And then probably start having conversations with them about how can we work together, knowing that you're most likely talking to the very same donors.
Yeah. And you know what? I've started to see a few examples where, you know, some people have started to really think about this. How can we maybe come together without fully coming together in terms of like a merger? And I've seen a few examples where you've had the same charities that are operating the same space, but what they've done is actually, we're struggling to fill our events. This is how it started. So they were like, okay, we need to hit this fundraising goal, but we also need to host this event. And the event was in the same city. So what I remember seeing the first one where it was, the event got renamed, but it was supporting equally the three charities. And then all of them were fundraising together at the same event. And I remember something like the stat, but overall, all of them raised a considerable percentage more than when they were going it alone. And from what I understand as well, I've seen a couple of examples like that now. And those said nonprofits are talking about coming together now, because I think they've started to realize, well, you know, if we can do an event together and that's less confusing to the donor, we're not, you know, fighting against each other for that same person. That was proof in the pudding that it actually could work in that way as well, where you don't have to go all the way to a merger as well.
Sure. You know, in the US, you know, we're coming into summer here. We're coming into what's called gala season, which is the fall. You know, everyone comes back, they go start going to schools, and there's events pretty much every night. And sometimes donors have to choose between my school is having an event and this one, you know, this other charity is having an event, and which one do I go to? And so it makes so much more sense to do something on a larger scale. You know, I was speaking to a charity yesterday. I said, it was a military charity. And I said, you know, you all need a super fund. And you're all trying to do the same thing separately. But if you came together and created a much bigger goal and target that the donors can see, then that would be helpful. So I tell my clients all the time, you need a big vision. Most donors don't want to give to small things. They want to give to big things. But, you know, if you're a small charity with a small budget, then what is the big thing? And that's why collaboration would make sense. I would rather have, you know, five charities working together, you know, on a solution to a problem, and then work together and having a major funding initiative towards that. And like you said, they'll gain more money that way than on the one-off.
Yeah. And you know what? It's different, but trying to give an analogy. If you think about the way that the world has dealt with COVID and vaccines, I know there was a load of collaboration that happened there as well. But traditionally, you know, launching a vaccine would take years and years and years of testing and all those different things. And we managed to pull it off within a matter of months. Obviously, there was a lot of, you know, rules and regulations were changed and things like that. But we did hear, especially on the European side, of so much more collaboration and people coming together and sharing because they wanted to fix that problem and quickly. And I think that was different because we were pushed because the world stopped. But it's the same with charities, isn't it? You're trying to quite often fix a health problem or, you know, poverty or all these different things. But you're right. If you're in it together, could you actually solve the problem quicker rather than going it separately?
Yeah, you know what? It's kind of money drives the change. So in that example, you know, I have a friend who has cancer and you know, went with them to the office, and the oncologist said, look, you know, so much money was poured into research for COVID that it's actually going to help the cancer research, because they struggled in cancer research, you know, working in silos to get the money to try and solve the problem. But what's happened is that so much money came in for COVID, but they were able to find solutions to some of the cancer diseases and they're working on creating vaccines to solve that because of the money, amount of money, the large sum that went into one central place that provided the research money to do what they needed to do.
Wow, it's amazing. And it just showed you just, you know, things like that. There can be so many offshoots of positivity in terms of, you know, like that is an amazing thing that is happening around us. But, and again, it just kind of hones in back to that consideration around doing things together and being open and sharing. It really just can change anything. Even with what I do, the more open and collaborative we are, the better our company seems to be coming. I think it's the same with everything you do, isn't it, in a way?
Sure, because you can't be all things to all people, you know. I mean, I'm thinking about food insecurity right now, because I was talking to somebody. They have a charity that has 400 acres, and they supply the food to different food banks in the area, and they're collaborating with Feeding America. And so all the food banks and Feeding America are all working together. So that's a great story to tell the donor. So why should I give to you? Well, because giving to us helps us do what we need to do and has a global impact, if you will, for food insecurity.
And people love when we work together. But we all love a team. You know, it's just I did this and I, we all try and train ourselves not to say that way as you go through your career, don't you? But when you do deliver things as a team or together, I think donors like that. And they like that story. And like, oh, great. You know what? Everyone's working together. It's one goal. I just think it's such a positive story overall for everybody.
Yeah, we have, you know, the United Nations has the SDGs, the, you know, sustainable goals. You know, we have global problems to solve. We really do. And I've said for as long as I've been doing this work, all the money in the world exists to solve all the problems in the world, except it kind of goes through a funnel, you know, of things that get used up in that money for charity at the end. So you don't have as much money. And I think one of the things that is a cost expense is having too many. And I wish this is probably needs to be regulated on a government level. Too many charities doing the same thing. In the same communities. And if you could cut out all the, and I'm not trying to say that anybody needs to lose their jobs in this, but there is, you know, think about how many offices and rents that there are, you know, how many, you know, prospect researchers do you have, you know, and, you know, just go down the line. And it's not a matter of if, it's when. And because if the nonprofits don't make the changes, then AI will make the change, or the donors based on how they're giving their money, because they don't just have charities to give to now. They have different things that they're giving to. That will cause a change as well. And so you have to rethink, you know, how you do business and, you know, how you're asking for money and where your revenue streams are.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack there and say, but you're right. All these things need to be thought about and they need, these conversations need to be had. So I think, again, for people listening, I just think it's not about being scared or fearful of it. And like you said about the, you know, yes, they can happen with job losses, but not always. I think just being also being the person that's starting the conversation, like, you know what, maybe we should be thinking about this or even chatting about it. That's showing that you're being innovative. And like you said, because it's going to happen at some point, not every charity, that's not going to happen to every charity, but there is going to come a point where people start to really think about it and be like, well, maybe we need to push you into it because this isn't kind of working. We actually could get there a lot quicker. So I think it's just like, from my point, I just think we all need to start having that chat and at least thinking about where to start.
Like I said, I'm not trying to create consternation on anyone's part or have anyone say, you know, well, you're a little crazy. The point of all this is to try and think forwardly, if that's a word, and be creative in how you're approaching donors. Because at the end of the day, your money has to come from somewhere. And it's, you know, for me, I'm a major gift fundraiser. You know, I'm not a grant writer, but what is your message that you have that gives you the distinction? And some small charities, you know, are happy existing on a very small budget and doing their thing. And that gives them a great sense of accomplishment, but is that sustainable? You know, because we have charities, you have charities in the UK and we have charities in the US that are over 100 years old. And then some that are, you know, 20 years old that have budgets 10 times than the ones that were started 100 years ago. So what are they doing that's different?
And that is definitely a question that people should ask. And I know exactly what, I've seen examples like that where, especially I've seen recently where you've seen more younger charities where the actual demographic of the employees and people working there are sometimes thinking a bit differently. And I've seen a few examples where they've told me how they're running things and even what the board is made up or the committee is kind of half of the people are below the age of 35. And some of the things they've told me about how they're running it, and I'm like, wow, I never thought of that. And then when they tell me their stats and what they're raising and their engagement, it's sometimes off the scale. But sometimes I think like when you deep dive and really try and look at the way you kind of internally run as well, that can be massively impactful as well as being collaborative. But sometimes it is that, it's like a legacy fundraising sometimes needs to be looked at, I think, and maybe a little bit of a shakeup. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. You know, as you're speaking, I'm just thinking about, you know, I just got off the phone with an international fundraising team, you know, and there's a lot of European charities and, you know, Australian and Asian that set up charities within the U.S. to raise money in the U.S. And there's a lot of U.S. charities that raise money overseas for different things. And again, that's created more competition and, you know, the opportunity for even like if you take a bunch of academic institutions in the UK, for instance, that are raising money in the U.S., would it make sense for them to work collectively? I don't have the answer to raise money in the U.S. for those academic institutions in the UK.
Yeah, and it's a good point. And one thing just quickly I've noticed as well in my time in Givergy is the amount of global charities that we now work with has massively increased from when I first started. It's surprising how many calls I have with clients. And I'm like, right, so we now work with you in America, Canada, US. And I go through all the lists and I'm like, it's amazing. But that before was like such a rarity. Now it seems to be more and more where they're like, yeah, okay, so we are expanding into this country. Can you help us? It is interesting how that's changing and people are now thinking, well, let's go everywhere. And for some, it's working really well.
Yeah, and it's different. You know, it's like years ago, I went to one of the early international fundraising conferences in the Netherlands. And when I went, I was quite surprised. There were like 1,000 fundraisers from 63 different countries there. And so it is on a global scale, but you know, we use different languages. So like in the UK, face-to-face fundraising is different than what we say in the US for face-to-face fundraising. And so everything's not the same around the world, but at the end of the day, we're still trying to have an impact to make this world a better place and help those who are less fortunate.
100%. Well, we've run out of time, but I think we've covered a lot and, you know, there's been some great conversations. So firstly, I just want to say an enormous thank you to you, Paul, for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed your time on the Givergy podcast.
I love it. And Ben, it's just great getting to know you and what Givergy does.
No, same to you. Well, we hope that you've enjoyed today's episode and found the content informative. If you want to hear more from Paul, head over to highimpactnonprofit.com to see how he supports nonprofits and be sure to order his book, The Future of Fundraising, which is available on Amazon. I've done it, I've read it, and I've really enjoyed it. He is also featured in another episode this season as well, which is What is the Future of Fundraising, ironically. We would love to hear your thoughts, though, so please feel free to email podcast@givergy.com. You can also make suggestions of future topics or guests you would love to hear on the show. Thank you again, and don't forget to subscribe or follow to listen and look out for our next episode.